Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, America's radical 20th century backlash against immigration was not about jobs or resources or skills. It was all about keeping the country white. We'll spend this hour with Jia Lin Yang, deputy national editor at the New York Times. Her own parents were able to emigrate from Taiwan only after the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act reversed earlier bans on newcomers from Asia. We'll talk about the unexpected results of last-minute changes to promote family reunification and about how we started to define ourselves as a nation of immigrants. Our conversation starts after a short break. Immigration laws are drafted by people who talk about jobs and skills and economic potential. But just under a century ago, the United States passed a law so restrictive it slowed migration to a trickle to the specifications of lawmakers who were mostly concerned with maintaining a white majority. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It changed starting in 1965, when President Lyndon Johnson took advantage of national mourning for the assassinated John F. Kennedy to push through a radically new set of rules around immigration, one that made it possible for millions of new arrivals from previously underrepresented parts of the world, including Asia and Africa. As it turned out, aspects of the law designed to placate white supremacists actually made the population more diverse, a change that is celebrated by some Americans and deeply resented by others. Jia Lin Yang is here to talk about this. She's deputy national editor at the New York Times and former deputy national security editor at the Washington Post, where she was part of a team awarded the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of Trump and Russia. Her new book is called One Mighty and Irresistible Tide, The Epic Struggle Over American Immigration, 1924 to 1965. Jia Lin, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
So your parents moved to the U.S. to study. They stayed to start their careers and their family here. How had you thought about the American philosophy of immigration growing up?
I thought of it as the simple notion of a nation of immigrants, right? That kind of banner mythology that we carry with us. I think a lot of us are taught it in school, and we think of there's just been a successive wave of immigrants, right? So I thought of my family as just like the Irish who came right after the potato famine, the Jews who came, the Italians who came, and then there was my Chinese family in the 60s and 70s. And so I hadn't really given it much thought. And frankly, I took it for granted that we were allowed to be here because in addition to seeing, you know, that there have been immigrants here for many generations, I grew up in Northern Virginia, where I'm sitting right now, and my friends were also the children of immigrants, and they were from places like Afghanistan, Iran, Eastern Europe. So I just took it to be as a matter of course that we always welcomed immigrants, and that's just who we are.
It's been hard for me to get my head around the fact that we talk about ourselves as a nation of immigrants with great pride, and we like to think about our immigrant histories, and yet there is so much resistance lately to people coming from other parts of the world.
Yes, this whole notion of this whole identity of being a nation of immigrants is very much on the table. And I began this project. I mean, for me, the fascinating thing was to learn that we hadn't always wanted immigrants. And it sounds naive to say that now, given our current situation, but I hear people describe, you know, they see things that the Trump administration is doing, and people will say things like, well, we've always been a nation of immigrants. We can't stop people. We've always wanted them. And to which I would respond now after doing this research, we have absolutely stopped people from before. And, you know, that's the effort now, but it's not new what's happening.
So I was surprised to learn we didn't even require passports until well into the 20th century. When did the U.S. start trying to keep track of immigration or even visitors arriving here from some other country?
Yeah, so the thing to know is that a little over 100 years ago, we had no visas. I think the passport system sort of really only emerges after World War I. So if we imagine what it was like to come here during that time, so you don't need a visa, first of all, before you get here. You really show up, and if you can make the journey, if you can take the steamship, or if you can cross the border from Mexico to the U.S., you're basically in. You know, you stop somewhere at Ellis Island famously, and someone checks to see if, you know, maybe you have some medical issue, or we would block people who had epilepsy, for instance, but only a very small percentage of people were turned away. So if you could physically make the journey and someone approved you medically, essentially, you could come here. And not only could you come here, but you weren't going to be deported. I mean, that the notion that you would settle here, make a life, and then years down the road, someone would show up and say, you've got to go, that was unthinkable. And so I think we just have to imagine that in the past, our borders were quite open. I mean, they were essentially open. There were no numerical limits. And if you got here and wanted to stay and make a life here, you really could.
So a lot of listeners might be aware that the giant, glaring exception to that was people from China for a long time. They were the first specific target of immigration bans. Today, we recognize that racism was clearly an enormous part of the calculus. Did the architects of the Chinese Exclusion Act even try to create a non-racist justification for the ban?
Not really. And that law is, as you point out, extremely important. So if we imagine that we were always kind of open borders, that's the first law that our country passes that explicitly singles out an ethnic group of immigrants and says, we don't want you here. And that law is really important to understand because it's not only the first of that kind, but it kind of sets in motion this idea of, you know, we've had, this is a young country, right? It's the 1880s, turn of the 20th century. And begins to be the sense of, well, we had these Chinese people coming. We don't want them because they're changing the country too much ethnically. Then we have this incredibly historic wave between 1880 and 1920 of Italians, of Eastern Europeans, many, many Russian Jews come to the US and they transform cities like New York just overnight. The city is just gone from, you know, some Jewish population to an enormous one. And they dress differently, they worship different religions. They just seem really different. And just as there was a backlash to the Chinese laborers who came out to the West, you know, in the 1800s, this new wave to places like New York also triggers a backlash. And so, well beyond the Chinese Exclusion Act, the country passes something even more ambitious in the 1920s that creates a whole new system of visas for the first time and ethnic quotas that say, we don't want people from Eastern Europe. We don't want people from Southern Europe. We want to get back to America's Anglo-Saxon Protestant roots, and we're going to codify that into our very immigration laws.
All right, let's talk about those quotas. How did the specific parameters to limit and control immigration, rather, get tied to the 1890 census instead of what would have been the most recent one in 1920?
It only makes sense if you understand the project they're doing. So if you think about how people are worried about all these people coming in. And the people who are worried are all across stratas of American society. It's a number of people who are actually quite elite. This is like the cream of the crop of Upper East Side New York society. They are, I'd say, I guess snobs is sort of the easiest way to describe them, but they feel like they've come from like good stock, right? Good American stock. And all these new people are showing up and they're really kind of degrading the quality of the average American. And in their minds, even more, you know, in the more extreme concern is these people aren't fit for our democracy. They're not the right kind of people. And it's not just snobbery at this point, too. It's actually backed by, you know, at the time, what was considered science, which is eugenics. And there's a whole area of study that people who are elite intellectuals, fields of economics, of paleontology, all kinds of people get behind eugenics, and they are studying different races of people and trying to piece together what they see as patterns that show, okay, you know, people of the Hebrew race have these tendencies, people of this race are kind of different. And out of that science, there is a very kind of huge body of research and work that comes out that really ranks the races. And so, for these people, to get back to your question, they look at all the people who've been coming, and in their minds, oh my goodness, these are different people. We have the science. They're, you know, they're more prone to criminality. This is the thing that they said about Italian immigrants. So we have got to stop them. And if all of them came after 1880, we have got to turn the clock back. Not to 1920 because they're already here now. We've got to go back to 1890 before all of them were here, back when we only had, you know, mostly people from England, some Germans, some Irish, but none of these new people who've come. And so they write into the law let's base these numbers on the 1890 census and really try to replicate what the country was like ethnically then, so that we could try our best. We can't stop, you know, all these people are already here. We can't turn them back. But here on out, we're going to try to turn back the clock ethnically.
Were all the people doing eugenics white people of Western European descent?
Yes, they were all Anglo-Saxon Protestant. This is the term WASP, right, which I sort of took for granted too before I worked on the book. This is really a time when people who feel like they're kind of the standard bearers of WASP culture are really, they're very much in charge of the country, and they see all these sort of up and coming immigrants as a threat. And so very much it's the power elite of America who's behind these laws, and they marshal the forces of science and wealth and political power to get them passed.
So presumably some of the kinds of people who arrived in this country after 1890 and had voting rights would have resisted these ideas. But how did World War I shift the way more Americans thought about immigration?
World War One, you know, I found myself realizing throughout this book sort of the funny ways that I'd been taught some of these events in American history. You know, World War One, I thought, was taught to me as sort of the precursor to World War Two, also an American victory, and just sort of almost like the prequel to the other war. And that was kind of it. And when I dug in, it became clear that that war really triggered a huge wave of American isolation, like an isolationism, a lot like what we saw with the Trump campaign. So not quite make America great again, but slogans very similar to that about getting back to America, right? 100% America, just getting back to the basics, because it felt like the country had gotten mixed up in European affairs and they got dragged into this war, which, you know, I think if you do learn about World War One, you do learn that the war was you know, quite an error of judgment, and kind of, and all these people died without much of a point. And for Americans who went over and came back, and for the American public, it just seemed like this war was a bad, just a bad exercise in foreign policy and getting mixed up in other people's affairs. And so it was time to get back to a closed border mindset of, we're not going to be on the global stage, we're going to just be America. And so that really feeds a lot of this anti-immigrant feeling. There's also fear of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, that there are these radicals beyond our borders. We don't want them here. There also was a lot of, you know, there was an anti-black, huge, like some of the worst racist mobs, anti-black mobs that we've seen in this country's history all occur in the early 20s. Sort of also, I would argue, in kind of the sort of in the aftermath of World War One, right? So the country comes out of that war more isolationist, more skeptical of people who aren't white, especially Catholics too. So in this, and you know, we think of Catholics as white, or Italians and Irish as white, but at the time they were viewed with suspicion too. So all of this mixed together really fuels this giant push for anti-immigration laws.
And obviously, that would close the door on a lot of people who had been left sort of decimated and poor by World War I in Europe.
Yes, throughout our history, you see moments where anytime we're worried about our economy here, people, our leaders find ways to try to fix that by limiting the kind of immigrants who can come. And so what you see in the 20th century too is the beginning of this notion of, if you're going to come here, we have to make sure you're not going to be what was called, quote unquote, a public charge. So you're not going to be dependent on welfare. You know, you somehow can have to prove that when you get here, you can take care of yourself. And of course, as you point out, as we see with these wars and the huge refugee crises that come after them, this makes it really hard for people who have lost everything in their countries from war, and they show up here, and we basically say, well, by definition, you can't come here because you can't take care of yourself financially.
What role did the Klan play in lobbying for more restrictions on immigration?
The KKK is resurgent at this time, and it's important to understand that they are not exactly the same Ku Klux Klan from the Reconstruction era after the Civil War, of course. This is a new group, essentially, with the same iconography, but they are, in addition to being anti-Black, they're very much anti-Catholic. anti-Semitic. So they are, again, yet another prong of American society that wants to preserve this Anglo-American Protestant identity. And they take off all over the country. This is well beyond the South. I was surprised to learn they were big on Long Island and New York. They were all over the Midwest. And they were very public, actually. You know, we think of these cross burnings at night, which they did, but they would also have these huge, almost like fair-like events. And they get behind this immigration law too and help pass it.
My guest is Jialin Yang, deputy national editor at the New York Times and author of One Mighty and Irresistible Tide, The Epic Struggle Over American Immigration, 1924 to 1965. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour, Jialin Yang, is deputy national editor at the New York Times and author of a new book called One Mighty and Irresistible Tide, The Epic Struggle Over American Immigration, 1924 to 1965. Jialin, was the 1924 Immigration Act controversial when it passed?
To some degree, but you know, there was so much disillusionment with the idea of admitting immigrants. You know, this was a time when the idea of a melting pot, which I think we're all familiar with, was being really questioned. You know, it had been something that was celebrated, this idea that all these different families and people from Europe would come together and create this kind of new American race, even. That had really fallen out of favor. And so when these laws were passed, the first one, 1921, you know, and then they create these quotas because they take a long time to actually piece together what the numbers are going to be. They're essentially passed in the 20s. By the time it happens, there's just not that much resistance. And overnight, you know, it does exactly what everyone wanted. It shuts off immigration from huge parts of the country. The number of immigrants just plummets. And this is very much by design. So the country has kind of abandoned the notion of the melting pot, abandoned the idea that we're all familiar with, too, that Emma Lazarus poem, right, at the foot of the Statue of Liberty about give me your huddled masses. People were openly talking about this is the end of that era of us taking in these people. We're going to get back to a much whiter, more Protestant America. And this whole notion of taking in all these immigrants, that's a thing of the past.
So another thing that happened was that the Chinese Exclusion Act was broadened to become the Asian Exclusion Act. Again, did anybody even try to justify why that was something we needed to do? Or did many Americans think that keeping people of Asian descent out of the country was justification enough?
This part of the law is really interesting. So, you know, you have to remember that at the time when you thought about immigration in America, people thought automatically about Europe, right? That was where the vast majority of immigrants came from. But always kind of in the background, increasingly at this time, especially out West, there are these Asian immigrants showing up. So there was a ban on Chinese laborers, as we talked about in 1882. When that began, you know, more Koreans, more Japanese immigrants came kind of in their wake to take these really hard jobs in the mines and on the railroads that the Chinese laborers had done, but were no longer able to since they were banned. And so as lawmakers were discussing these quotas, there was a real push to say, well, we should also exclude Asian immigrants, and we don't want them either. But in this case, this was actually trickier for them because, you know, one thing I learned too throughout this research is that we think usually right now of immigration as kind of a domestic politics issue, right? It's about whether we Americans want people from the outside. But in our history, it's often viewed as a foreign policy thing. Because if you think about it, how we treat immigrants, right, and who we allow to come and from where actually has a lot to do with our relationship with those countries. And so during this debate, this whole idea of what are we going to do about Japanese immigrants comes up. And there's a huge push from California lawmakers to say, we've got to extend these bans. We have to ban more Asians. There are all these Japanese people coming. We don't want them here. But there was this huge pushback from people, including the Secretary of State, to say, wait a second, if we do this, we're going to really anger the Japanese government. We don't want that. So there was a huge back and forth. You know, the nativists ended up having the upper hand. But a lot of people think that, you know, by extending the ban to Japanese immigrants, which these quotas did as well, we angered the Japanese so much that we actually sowed the seeds for the Pearl Harbor attack. It really damaged U.S.-Japan relations. But, you know, during the debate, the fixation really domestically was on, we have all these Asian immigrants coming here, and we've got to put a stop to them too.
The other nightmare this engendered during World War II was that we turned away hundreds of thousands of Jews looking to escape Europe and get away from the Holocaust. Can you talk about how specifically the law was written, with the intention of turning Jews away for immigration?
Right, so they passed the law, it works as expected, and then here comes World War II and just a tremendous, tremendous refugee crisis, right? And of course, when you look at the laws, it specifically cuts off people from Eastern Europe. And so all of these, especially Jewish lawmakers, Jewish leaders in America, are pointing to this growing crisis, you know, across the Atlantic. They're saying there's a Holocaust, people are trying to get out. And we have these quotas, and we just cannot admit people. And their stories literally of ships showing up filled with Jewish refugees trying to come ashore to the US. They can, you can, you know, there's a famous one called the St. Louis. This is the name of the ship. And they got so close that they could see like the lights of Miami, but they didn't have visas. So they were turned away. And again, this is all new, right? This is the new system that's been put in place in the 20s. And finally, in World War II, you see the consequences of that. And what's really tragic is that during the war, I mean, people, you know, the Holocaust was something that people didn't fully understand in the moment either, right? The details of it sort of only fully came tumbling out after the war. But people knew that there were all these people trying to get into the US. And domestically, there just wasn't an appetite for it. There was a view that these were, again, these were mostly Jewish refugees. We don't want Jews here. You know, they could be radicals, and there was still a lot of anti-Semitism. And so every sort of bare bones attempt to change the laws during the war, even to admit children or orphan children, was rejected. And so this actually, though, really fuels this desire after the war, because there are even more refugees after the war, right? So many people have been displaced. But all of this struggle against the quotas is what starts feeding this idea of, wait a second, we passed these laws in the 20s, but we should really think about abolishing these quotas. These don't work for our country. And this is where the push to overturn them and to get rid of them really begins.
So Manny Seller, people may not have heard of him. He was a congressman. He emerges here as a real hero.
Yes, he's fascinating to me because he's one of these people who serves in Congress for many years and is very, very powerful in his time and quite well known, but you know, by now we've sort of forgotten. He's a person he's the grandson of German Jewish immigrants. He's born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. And he enters Congress right when these quotas are being passed in the 20s. And he's in Congress until the 70s. And so he's one of the longest serving congressmen in American history. And he basically sees the whole arc of this fight over the quotas, right? When he begins his congressional career, they're passed. And he spends the next 40 years trying to overturn them. And he's motivated by his own, you know, heritage as the grandson of immigrants. Also, his constituents in Brooklyn are from all over Europe. They're immigrants themselves. And he just finds it to be a giant affront to sort of the American spirit to have these quotas. And his horror at them only grows during World War II after seeing what happens during the Holocaust and afterwards when there are all these refugees and the US still will not admit them.
What we should note that the 1924 Immigration Act also established the U.S. Border Patrol. What had the rules been before for travel between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada? And why did they have sort of special privileges that other countries didn't have?
So these borders were especially open. And, you know, as I was saying earlier about foreign policy, this seemed obvious to American leaders at the time because it was a matter of being good neighbors, right? You have these countries bordering you. You want to keep good relations with them. You want to stay friendly. And so it's just seemed logical that you should basically have open borders. Again, if you could cross the Rio Grande, if you could make it across the border, you could come in. And there was a lot of, you know, temporary farm labor coming in and out seasonally, and that seemed perfectly fine. And during this debate over the quotas, I should add, you know, it did come up this question of, well, we have these open borders in the Western Hemisphere. We don't have any quotas. Should we add any? And people were so tied to this idea of being good neighbors with Canada and Mexico that during this whole debate, where quotas are being added for Eastern Europe and Asia and other parts of the world, they maintained those open numbers and borders in the Western Hemisphere. So no numerical limits were added to these immigrants.
What happened in 1952 with the passage of the McCarran-Walter Act?
So if you imagine that these quotas are intact, all these Jewish lawmakers are trying to change them. They're totally not succeeding. The next moment where there is a big push to rethink American immigration and is 1952. And for me, this was really interesting because if you think about right now, you know, it is so hard to get immigration reform, right? It's like this pipe dream in Congress. People talk about it and we wait years and years and years. And the same was true of the 20th century. So it's been, you know, 30 years between the 1920s and 1952, you come around and people say, okay, it's time to rethink our immigration system. Let's look at it anew. And so all the people who oppose the quotas think, okay, this is our chance to get rid of the quotas, right? We've seen World War II, we've seen from the Holocaust, the refugee crisis, these don't work, we've got to change them. But they're blocked by a very powerful senator named Pat McCarran from Nevada, who's head of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And so he oversees all of the country's immigration policy. And if you've ever flown into Las Vegas, you might remember that the airport there is named after him. It's the McCarran International Airport. And he, again, sort of like Manny Sellers, one of these people so powerful and famous at the time, but all but forgotten now. And he's interesting because he was very, very, very anti-communist. You know, he's the son, he's Irish Catholic, son of Irish immigrants. So you'd think if you're the son of Irish immigrants, maybe you're pro-immigration, but no. He is incredibly worried about Jewish radicals, communists coming in. And so when the immigration system is being looked at anew in 1952, there's a chance to maybe change it. He really blocks all those attempts under the banner of anti-communism. He was a true McCarthyist. And so when they pass this big immigration law in 1952, it basically renews the whole, you know, national origins quota system that was in place before. They make other changes that are interesting. You know, they allow Asians to naturalize for the first time. That's sort of an interesting sort of subplot of all this. But by and large, this whole big system of visas, of quotas based on the ethnicity, those are really intact. And all these people who are trying to change the laws are really dejected afterwards because they've waited so long and yet they lose again.
Was it reasonable in the early 50s, at the sort of height of the Cold War, for people to have been afraid that there would be some communist takeover of this country, or was that threat always inflated?
You know, if you look at what McCarthy himself, right, the senator from Wisconsin, I mean, he was always kind of hyping evidence that he had that the American government had been infiltrated by communists. And, you know, the Communist Party was real in the US and there was, you know, active interest. But I think this notion that the government had been fully infiltrated, the Truman administration was just filled with spies, and that the country was really kind of, you know, that there was all these spies from within. I think if we look back, quite a bit of that was overstated, and there was such a kind of hysteria over it that a lot of innocent people's lives were destroyed. You know, there were some people who clearly had committed espionage, but many more, I think, who were unfairly accused. And, you know, the issue is that it really bled into immigration policy in ways that were kind of hard to justify. You had stories of people, you know, American citizens who were radical, who questioned the American government sometimes over civil rights and on a racial segregation, I'm thinking, and they would have their passports revoked. They would have trouble leaving the country or coming back in. And this was all part of this kind of McCarthyist fervor in Washington that was not only in Congress but took over corners of the State Department. The people who approved visas and passports, all of them were trying to keep out spies. And so, in a lot of cases, it really got out of control because innocent people who were just, you had different political viewpoints were being blocked. And during the Cold War, this became an issue too, because you saw a lot of people trying to escape communist regimes, people who wanted to come to America specifically because it wasn't communist. And yet, a lot of this McCarthyist anti-immigration sentiment would block even these people from coming. And so you saw people like President Truman get really frustrated thinking, you know, I'm trying to fight the Cold War, and yet our immigration laws are making it harder for me to do that.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So, John F. Kennedy entered the House of Representatives in 1947. How did he vote on McCarran-Walter?
So he supports this law. And if you kind of think about what Kennedy is like at this moment, he's a young man who kind of stumbles into politics. His older brother, Joe Sr., died in an accident during World War II, flying a very risky mission in Europe. And sort of the mantle of trying to claim political power in the Kennedy family falls to him. And he runs for Congress. And he's someone who, you know, speaking of sort of the WASP ideal. The Kennedy family has really embraced it. They're Irish Catholic, but by the time JFK is growing up, you know, his father Joe Sr. is really into being in Palm Beach and Cape Cod and sailing, and they've really tried to assimilate and embrace wholesale like elite white American culture. And when he's running for Congress, he's running in this district in Boston that is filled with immigrants. And so suddenly he has got to think about himself as someone who is, you know, more pro-immigration and identifies as the descendant of immigrants. But early on in his career, he's also very anti-communist. So when the McCarran-Walter Act comes along, he's sort of caught between these and essentially is still very much in the anti-communist mode. So he sides with the law. But what you see over the course of his career is kind of this evolving thinking about immigration that is partly about his family, but also I'd argue about his own political fortunes.
It's hard not to notice that McCarthy and McCarran and Kennedy were all Irish. I believe they were all Irish Catholics. Was there something about being an Irish Catholic in this time in history and the possibility of sort of ascending into white status, which had not been afforded to them previously, that caused them to be more hardline on immigration than they might have been otherwise?
I think that's probably true. It's a little bit hard to say. I think they each had their own motivations, but I think we have to remember that when you go back in time, I mean, racial categories are constantly changing. So who's considered white, who's not, is a thing that moves over time. It's not static. And so for these Irish Catholic lawmakers, you know, they have a chip on their shoulder because they're not seen as part of the American mainstream. They're seen as different. They're seen as Irish and Catholic. And, you know, there was a lot of discrimination against Irish immigrants when they first came to the US. And even JFK's father felt like he faced some discrimination when he was at Harvard, a student there even. And so I think this feeling of having to prove that they belong, I mean, you see this in our history. You see this even now with some immigrant populations. When you come to this country and you're trying to really make it, right? You're chasing the American dream. You're trying to assimilate. One of the easiest ways to prove that you are part of the mainstream is to telegraph who you reject. It might be, you know, it might be Black Americans who you reject, right? As a way of saying, I'm not with them. I'm with these sort of mainstream white Americans. And the same goes, I think, for immigration, possibly, right? Like, I'm not with the Jews and the Italians who are here, that these newer people, I'm with the people who've been here all along. I'm part of the power structure. And so I do think there are these people kind of caught between it, right? Because in the early 20th century, if you're Irish Catholic, you know, you're closer to the mainstream now than you were before. If you're Jewish, if you're Italian, you're not really. You're really trying to kind of meld into the country. And, you know, events like World War II, I think, really helped solidify people's sense of belonging. And I think this whole idea of who counts as white really expands during this time. And by the time you get into the 50s, people who are Jewish, people who are Italian, seem more like white Americans than they used to be.
My guest is Jialin Yang. She's deputy national editor at the New York Times and author of One Mighty and Irresistible Tide, The Epic Struggle Over American Immigration, 1924 to 1965.
Our beautiful America was built by a nation of strangers from 100 different places or more. They have poured forth into an empty land, joining and blending in one mighty and irresistible tide. The land flourished because it was fed from so many sources, because it was nourished by so many cultures and traditions and people. And from this experience, almost unique in the history of nations, has come America's attitude toward the rest of the world.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was President Lyndon Baines Johnson in 1965 signing the Immigration and Nationality Act. My guest this hour is Deputy National Editor at the New York Times, Jialin Yang, whose book is called One Mighty and Irresistible Tide, The Epic Struggle Over American Immigration, 1924 to 1965. Jialin, you note in the book that LBJ, over the course of his lifetime, had a number of close friendships with Jewish people. How did those relationships shape his thinking on immigration?
I think LBJ was someone who just instinctively sided with underdogs. You know, he thought of himself very much as one, someone from an impoverished family who goes to, you know, a college that no one's heard of. And, you know, when he thinks of himself compared to the Kennedy family, for instance, he just has a lot, this huge sort of inferiority complex. But when he's coming up in politics, he really makes connections with the Jewish networks of Texas. And he even gets involved during World War II with special cases where constituents come to him and say, you know, I know someone who knows someone who's Jewish and trying to get out of Europe right now. And we could really use your help of trying to work our way through this complicated, really Byzantine visa system. And could you help save this person? And there are cases documented where he does try to intervene and he does save some people. There are others where it's too little too late. But clearly by the time he becomes vice president under JFK, when he's president, he has had firsthand experience with the immigration system to some degree. So he knows how it works.
He was also not one to ever pass up an opportunity to get a big piece of legislation passed if it was yes. possible. I mean, this wasn't, immigration didn't start out as the number one issue for either Kennedy or Johnson, right?
No, not at all. I mean, both parties at this point are campaigning on this idea, right? So they, you know, the quotas, if you think about them, are get less and less popular over time. So in 1952, they're kind of reinforced and revived again, renewed. But by the time the late 50s and 60s roll around, there's this kind of notion that, you know, these quotas are fundamentally actually racially discriminatory. And so if we're talking about the problems with Jim Crow, if we're talking about racial discrimination in our society, we've got to include these immigration laws as part of that conversation. And so both the Republican and Democratic parties begin to kind of turn on them, even under Eisenhower. And by the time Kennedy's elected, I mean, he's basically promised that I'm going to rethink this whole immigration system. I want to, it's discriminatory right now, and I really want to fix it. It helps, I think, get him elected even, because all these Irish, Italian, Jewish American voters look to him and say, you know, he's one of us in a way, and he's going to right this wrong. You know, it's not even necessarily someone who wants more immigrants. It's more of a symbol, right? Because it says this law symbolizes the notion that some people are more desirable based on their ethnicity than others. And so for all these Americans who are in the country, it's just, it's an insult to them. And so to them, it's time for the quotas to go. And so Kennedy, you know, for him, he's more obsessed with foreign policy, the Cold War, but he does get behind it. And the White House under him submits legislation, and it really goes nowhere quickly. It's this, again, yet another attempt to change immigration laws. And just as it is hard now, it was hard then, it kind of goes nowhere. And then he is assassinated, and LBJ inherits all the sort of unfinished work of JFK. And that includes this immigration law.
So this codicil to expand the ability of immigrants' families to join them, the family reunification, was added as a way to placate white supremacists?
Yes. So this is very confusing, because in the debate right now, you'll hear the Trump administration and conservative anti-immigration activists railing against what they call chain migration or family reunification. And this is the notion that, you know, in the long line for visas, we only have so many to give out, and people who have immediate family in the U.S. should get priority. And this comes out of the 1965 law, that this is sort of the highest priority, right, should go to people under this situation. The funny part is that originally under LBJ's proposal and JFK's, the highest priority, you know, you get rid of the ethnic quotas, first of all. So you say, we're not going to judge based on that. We need a whole new set of criteria. And for them, originally, the idea was highest priority goes to people with special skills, right? Engineers, doctors, things that we need in this country for our economy and for our society. But getting rid of the quotas is controversial. And it's controversial because there's still a lot of people who are worried that if we do that, we're going to again lose. Remember that whole notion from the 20s, like the ethnic heart of America, right? We can't allow America to not be a white Anglo-Saxon nation. And so in this back and forth of compromising and trying to win over these nativists, the nativists themselves come up with this idea of, well, if we do family reunification first, that'll actually help our cause of keeping America white. Because, you know, if you recall at this time, there just aren't that many immigrants from outside Europe. You don't see nearly as many people as we do now. And so in their mind, this is a way to keep the status quo, because if there aren't that many non-European immigrants here to begin with, it's not going to hurt to say, let in some other family members, because that's going to be mainly European. So in their mind, it's a way of maintaining the racial makeup of America. And so in the law that's passed, they flip the priorities. Special skills go second, and first goes family reunification.
And how did that play out in ways that the white supremacists did not expect?
You know, it plays out in ways that I'd say no one expected, mm-hmm. even the people who wanted it. You know, if you look back at the testimony, people like LBJ, Bobby Kennedy, who's attorney general, they're all downplaying what this law is going to do. Because for them, again, it's a symbolic thing. It's a way of saying we're not going to have racial discrimination in our immigration laws, just as we don't want Jim Crow laws anymore. They keep saying it's not going to change our country very much. But in fact, it really does. And by the early 70s, you already begin to see this. The number of Asian immigrants surpasses the number of European immigrants. And this is also because each president in fighting the Cold War keeps sort of doing these carve-outs, especially for refugees. So if you think about all the Vietnamese refugees that we admitted, Cuban refugees. So over time, all these different groups from outside Europe start coming in. And little by little, thanks to family reunification, they bring in, you know, brothers and sisters who come in, and these people bring in their spouses, who bring in their parents and their siblings, and thus was born our modern nation of immigrants, which, you know, anyone can tell you is far, far less European than what came before, and really transformed this country racially, ethnically, to the point where demographers who look at these numbers, you know, think that white Americans will fall below 50% of the American population in the coming decades, and fairly soon.
What sort of carve-out was made in 1965 to continue to restrict legal immigration rates from Mexico and Latin America more broadly?
So when they're debating all this, the whole idea of what to do with the Western Hemisphere comes up yet again, right? It came up a little bit in the 20s, comes up again in the 50s. And this time is also part of the compromise. You know, originally they don't want to add quotas to the Western Hemisphere because, again, they want to be good neighbors. But as part of a compromise, they do add numerical restrictions. And this is a huge deal as well for our current debate, because overnight, all of this migration that was perfectly legal, right? You don't need a visa. Becomes illegal overnight, because once you have a numerical cap, it's basically saying, well, anything past this is illegal. And thus was born, you know, this historian May Nye has done extraordinary work on this, thus was born our kind of current conception of the illegal immigrant, especially from Mexico.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones now. We have Joe on the line in Carrollton, Texas. Hi, Joe.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm trying to be brief. But I hope I get a good, juicy, meaty answer, because a lot of the content that is shared is often the same thing on interviews and the media. But normal people have authentic questions that just don't seem to get addressed. Specifically, we keep using history and tradition, but I don't know if that's legitimate, because we've had that history of not having vaccines, had a history of slavery, a history of abusing children. Is that proper? You know, that's a then, here is now, because does that mean everyone on this planet is entitled to immigrate? Do we have an infinite amount of food, land, water, jobs?
Well, Joe, thank you for your call. Maybe you can talk about that, Jialin. What are some ways that we can think about appropriate limits? I mean, it's true that no country can afford to take everybody, perhaps, who might wish to be there.
Yeah, I think we are just so overdue as a country to talk about this. You know, that is really what I arrived at from all of this research and the 4 years I spent on this book. I think we have to ask ourselves, so if we're not going to admit everyone, right? So we used to have open borders. And if we decide as a society, we don't want open borders, we just can't do it, which, you know, I think vast majority of Americans would say, then we're going to have to ask ourselves, so who do we want here? And I don't think we've really done that. Right now, we have this totally hodgepodge system where we have all the, you know, millions of people who are here without the proper papers, who are kind of living in the shadows. They have these jobs where they have no rights, and they're really being exploited in these jobs. We're seeing now during the COVID pandemic, people working in meatpacking facilities and getting sick. And, you know, the system, I think, is just quite broken. And then we also have not talked about, you know, if we are going to have this visa system that we erected 100 years ago, who gets priority, really, right? Like, do we want it to be people with family members already here? Do we want it to be people with special skills? What about refugees, right? Like, I just think we as a country seem to be overdue to step back and ask ourselves together these kinds of questions about who we want and who we don't. And I think the Democratic Party, especially, you know, with Trump as the president, it's become kind of easy for them to say, well, we're not Trump. You know, we love immigrants. We're a nation of immigrants. Like, we're not going to be like that. And it's, you know, it's like, okay, well, that's what you believe. But then what is the system you're going to put in place, right? Like, if we're going to have limits, we're going to have to make very difficult decisions about who can come in and who can't. And frankly, looking at the history, you know, I even have questions about my own family being here. Like, I'm obviously extremely grateful that this country made a place for us, that we are here. But I ask myself, you know, should we have been here instead of a family of refugees, of political refugees, right? People fleeing political oppression. That's not what happened to my family in Taiwan. So what, you know, should we have been ahead in line of somebody else? And I just think the Democratic Party especially has just kind of been avoiding these questions because I think they're very, very hard to answer.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You note in the book, none of us who were born here actually deserve to be American. We just had the good fortune to be born here. So, I mean, how can we make ethical and also practical decisions about who deserves to join us through immigration? I mean, is there a country that's getting this right somewhere in the world?
You know, we're very unique in that there's just no country like us with this many immigrants in it. And, you know, it's important to also remember that we are now at a historic high in terms of the number of percentage of foreign-born Americans. You know, the last time we were at this number sort of above 10%, well over 10%, was around the turn of the 20th century, that wave I described earlier of Jews and Italians coming in. We're back at those numbers. And that is what people like Stephen Miller in the Trump White House are responding to. I mean, I think for myself, I don't have answers as to what our system should look like. And in part because I think that's the thing that we democratically together have to negotiate. It's not a thing that one person can come in and say, voila, here's the answer. It's really a statement of our values. It's a statement of who we want here, what values we think people can stand for. And even questions that we have grappled with before, like, does ethnicity matter? Does it matter if people who come here are not from Europe? You know, do we care about that? To what degree do we want people speaking English? All these questions are at assimilation. And I think, you know, it's funny for me because with my own family, it's funny to learn about this law that allowed my family to be here and to realize that the fact that we're here and the fact that the law had this huge effect of admitting so many Asian Americans was something of an accident, right? That's a strange thing to realize. But I think the only way to proceed from that history is to think about what the people writing the law were trying to do ultimately, right? Because any big law that's written, people do not anticipate the consequences. And it's just simply, I don't think necessarily reasonable to expect that people writing a law can predict what will happen, you know, decades later. But I do think the principle of what they were doing is they were trying to eradicate essentially racism from our country's immigration laws. They were saying, we shouldn't be looking at your race and the color of your skin to decide whether you should come in. Let's look at these other factors. And I think it's time for our country now probably to think about, okay, revisit those other factors. Do we care about families? Do we care about refugees? Where do we stand on all of this? And we just haven't done that in quite a few years. And I think you see a lot of pent-up demand for that now.
Jia Lin Yang is deputy national editor at the New York Times and author of One Mighty and Irresistible Tide, The Epic Struggle Over American Immigration, 1924 to 1965. Jia Lin, thank you for spending this hour with us.
It was wonderful to be here. Thank you so much.
I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.